China has arrested another dissident on subversion charges, the third in a deepening security crackdown, his family said yesterday, while a Chinese-Australian writer who had disappeared in China contacted friends and said he was sick. Chen Wei, a dogged critic of China's one-party system who lives in Sichuan province, was arrested on charges of inciting subversion of state power. His wife, Wang Xiaoyan, said by telephone from the region. I received the notice yesterday afternoon, but I haven't had any other news about him, she said, and haven't been allowed to see him. She did not know the precise reason for the charge. Chen's arrest adds to evidence that the Chinese Communist Party is determined to snuff out any risks of challenges to its power as it approaches a leadership succession late next year, when President Hu Jintao retires. Now, that recent Reuters report from Beijing suggests that despite the influx of Western culture, the growth of capitalism and a consumer economy in the People's Republic of China, the repressive one-party state is still very much in control. But what is the likely future of China, and what is America's stake in it? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
As ethnic forces divide more and more countries, how will China hold its 1.3 billion people together? As China's population becomes increasingly urban, what is the effect on the divide between rich and poor? And what is the government trying to stop those dissident writers from saying? Our guest is Stephen Feuchtwang, a senior research associate of the Department of Anthropology at the London School of Economics. Since 1966, he's researched popular religion and politics in mainland China and Taiwan, which has resulted in a number of publications on charisma, place, temples, festivals, and politics.
Welcome to University of the Air and to Madison.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here. In fact, it's glorious weather outside, and if only a studio could be built in the open, but it can't. Yes. I'm very glad to be here in the studio.
Well, let me start by asking you, you know, as a China expert, you must at times cringe when you hear Americans getting it wrong about China. Could you start by perhaps saying what you think are the most common misconceptions that Americans have about China?
Yes, I don't think it's just Americans, by the way, but because China is still ruled by a single communist party, and that communist party can be quite oppressive, as you've just pointed out, there is an idea of China still being, as it were, Maoist, which is not true. And what I think people don't realize is that within China, a great deal more is possible, so long as it doesn't embarrass the party. But actually, that means quite a lot. Since I've been going to China and have a lot of friends in universities in China, I've been astonished at the amount by which a kind of freedom of speech within certain increasingly broadened constraints has occurred, which can, of course, be stopped occasionally with clampdowns. But it expanded in the 1980s, and then with 1989 and the clampdown on the student demonstrations, which didn't take place, it's another misconception, just in Beijing, in Tiananmen Square, but took place in most of the major cities in China. It was a very large uprising, maybe a way of calling it, and the clampdown then. There was a kind of disillusion amongst intellectuals and students who had been expanding the sense of their own freedoms. And many of them just became engaged in making money. But now it's grown again. 1989 was 20 years ago, so 20-plus years ago. And it's, I think, one of the things that is very difficult, even for somebody who goes to China as frequently as I do, which is approximately once a year, that the range of possibilities is enormous according to whether you have good connections. So the artist and dissident, a man called Ai Weiwei, that people may have read about, has been arrested recently for economic crimes. But he had good enough connections until now to for instance, protest and keep on protesting through his artworks in favor of the families in Sichuan, remember the earthquake in 2008, whose children were killed because of poor quality construction of schools, and who were at first acknowledged by the state and by a huge outflow from all parts of China of activist sympathy, funding, or just going to Sichuan in order to do whatever people could help. After that, later there were the Olympics, and also, of course, all the protests abroad on Tibet against the torchbearers, if you recall that, the people who really suffered in Sichuan were forgotten, but Ai Weiwei kept on recalling them and created artworks which named all the family names of all the children who had been killed.
Did that embarrass the party? Is that it why did. He was picked up?
It's an accumulation of things. That was one of them that he has insisted on doing. But quite a long time, partly because he is one of the designers of the Bird's Nest Stadium that was built for the Olympics in 2008. But partly he got that because he has good connections to people in authority. He was able to go on doing this. Now, China always foxes any kind of commentator, including me. Things happen and you don't quite know why. And I don't quite know why now there is this clampdown, which is actually very extensive and worrying. But even then, I know people who feel relatively unscathed about it, unscathed by it, and are prepared to be critical. Everything depends on what someone in the upper echelons of the regime thinks might be embarrassing to their authority. And that can be quite whimsical. And I think the Chinese Communist Party, that's another thing to say about it. The Chinese Communist Party is a vast organization. And it has a lot of different, not organized factions, but factions within it, which are of different views. And so which of them are having the main say at any one point is rather difficult to tell. Certainly for me, because I work on China from the bottom up rather than studying the top, which is what political scientists do. But I think even for political scientists, it's sometimes very, very difficult for them to know quite why this clampdown on dissenters or is happening. But in any case, my main point is that the sense that China is still, let's call it by the old term, a totalitarian state, is not true. It wasn't even true under Mao, in the sense that whatever Mao said happened. In the worst of times, which were the times when even cooking was collectivized, right? So that local carters had the sanction just to stop people eating, as it were, right? That was. But even at that time, a local carter, that's the name of a party member at the lowest level, could interpret whatever came from the top in a completely different way from the local carter somewhere else. So, and now that's loosened up enormously. There isn't a single power hierarchy. The fact that economic wealth can be accumulated by businessmen who can sponsor publications, or by publications who can make money out of investigative journalism, they're constantly testing the limits of what is tolerable. They know that there are limits, but they're constantly pressing against the envelope. And I think the gradual tendency is that the envelope is getting larger. But now is a time when it's
getting smaller.
Getting smaller again, yes.
You've got to watch that envelope.
Yes.
I would think one of the misconceptions about China might be just to view it as a sort of monolith. It's so huge with so many people. But I would think one of our misconceptions might be just to think of the Chinese as a single group of people rather than as containing such variety.
Yes. Thank you. That's I think, is a good point to make in general. I think even for people who study China, as I do, the variety is always a surprise. not only the variety, but everything changing so quickly that that one is never up to date. But I'll focus on the variety, which is that the plainly economic conditions vary hugely in China. So, for instance, the standard of living, the average standard of living and income in Shanghai is as good as any advanced nation. And Shanghai is as big as some small nations.
It certainly is.
But even if you go to the whole region of the Shanghai local economy, if you go to the fringes of it, you'll find quite poor people. And it's not that one common misconception is that you have the coastal regions which are rich and that the western regions which are poor and where most of the minority nationalities are. That is roughly true. But actually you can find really quite poor people within the confines of a very large and rich, in its terms of its production, city. So, for instance, in Midwestern China, if I can call it that, the city of Chongqing, which was part of Sichuan and it borders on Sichuan, was made into a provincial-level city. It became equivalent to a province. Within the boundaries, administrative boundaries of this enormous city of, if you count the whole population, it's 34 million people. So it's like Shanghai. But it includes some of the poorest villages in the whole of China. So that kind of income differential and variety also exists within cities, that actually you have construction workers who are extremely poor building apartments for the very, very rich. And the disparity of incomes is increasing in China. It's as great as it is in the U.S. And is very worrying to the central government. It's one of the things that they worry about.
Is there much of a middle class in China? Is it a rising middle class? I mean, we do hear about Chinese billionaires.
Yes.
Of course, which would be an extreme contrast with the vast number of people probably in rural areas in particular. But is there a middle class to speak of?
Yes, there is. I think it's a contentious issue of whether there is a middle class amongst us scholars. But the people who live on very pleasant walled garden estates, which can range from university professors to successful entrepreneurs, do, I think, consider themselves to have the status of a middle class. They don't have other characteristics of a middle class that are expected by people who are used to the economic and political trajectories of the history of Europe or of the USA. They haven't yet formed a civil society. They haven't yet formed completely autonomous organizations. And I don't think that's going to be the way China develops anyway. But there is something like a middle class. And the in terms of its being both cosmopolitan in the sense of looking outside China for its models of consumption, for the architecture of its houses, but also increasingly becoming part of a sense of pride in China's growing prominence. So one wouldn't expect people who look as if they're middle class all to be the same. There would be some who, for whom pride in being Chinese turns them into people who say, we shouldn't buy anything Japanese or we shouldn't buy U.S. products. But there'll be others who say, that's all we want. We want Japanese products and U.S. products. Or there'll be people who are very sympathetic to these dissident writers and others who say that they are damaging China's reputation abroad. People who are still slightly touchy about being proud of China, but then who have the means to articulate that. That's why I'm saying they're middle class. They have the means to subscribe to journals, to even found magazines.
Discretionary income, even.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. Do the very, very wealthy Chinese who are part of this apparently very rapidly growing Chinese economy and prosperity, does any of their wealth, as we would put it in this country, trickle down to the poor? I mean, collectively, is China better off now than it was, you know, 10 or 20 years ago because of this economic boom?
Well, as always, as you would expect from an academic, the answer is both yes and no. the yes answer is yes. There has been a huge reduction in absolute poverty. So that's occurred, you could call it a trickle-down effect, by the fact that the Chinese economy has grown enormously. Jobs have been created with relatively secure incomes, or a sufficient number of jobs for somebody who can become a migrant worker to keep changing jobs and maintain an income, and therefore and send enough money home for that household then to be brought out of chronic malnutrition, say. I'm talking, that's absolute poverty, right? But there are still are people who are below the UN poverty line. I mean, quite a lot of people, like several tens of millions of people. And that's another point to be made about China's variety, is that actually it's both an advanced country and a developing country. And one of the points to be made about the Chinese economy being so powerful, the second biggest in the world, is in some ways it gives a false impression. If you divide it by its population, which is what you should do, then the production and income per head is actually that of a developing country, like it's slightly better off than India, but like India. And so it's because it's a subcontinental country like India is too, there's enormous variety of both income, interest in the rest of the world, and so on and so forth. But because it's so connected to the world, for instance, the cable network that connects people to television viewing is, I think, something in it's 90+%. So even some of the very poor
have cable television.
Have access to cable television. So they see what's happening to the wealthy parts of China. They are induced to try and gain their own wealth by migrating, sometimes forced to migrate because the family just isn't wealthy enough to maintain them. And some of those actually go abroad. They come to the US, they come to countries of Europe. And so that these so-called peasants become world travelers and eventually traders, of course. But some of them, many of them that you don't hear about, of course, are constantly moving from job to job and are in a kind of depressed state of low income, which they can't break out of. But in any case, it's out of poverty, out of absolute poverty. And so there has been a reduction of poverty. The no answer to trickle down, I have remembered the question.
Yeah, I was waiting for it.
There's always the but.
The man who started the reforms that opened the Chinese economy, Deng Xiaoping, said, get rich first. You know, allow people to get rich first, it will trickle down. He was a trickle-down theorist, yeah. And people did get rich, but they didn't make everybody richer. They just increased the variety, if you see what I mean, right? There still
you mean
are.
Increase the gap?
Increase or? The gap.
Yeah.
Yes, sorry, the word variety was, I'm using too much. Because
so, so wasn't it as if you were spreading the wealth generally across the population? It's just that different kinds of people were getting rich?
Yes. And a lot more are rich than were. That's absolutely true. But it hasn't been a trickle-down in the sense that it's produced a reasonably good minimum income for everyone.
And
right?
how does the Communist Party sort of justify the accumulation of wealth with its own doctrine, if it's supposed to be sort of a more shared...
Well, with a new doctrine, yes. That was put forward by the person who followed Deng Xiaoping, a man called Jiang Zemin. He followed him as the ultimate leader. And he produced the theory of the three represents, that the party should represent three things. One was the most advanced, is using Marxist terminology, forces of production. The other was the most advanced culture and the most advanced people. So it's a sense of including those who can advance the economy, who are entrepreneurs. He had a battle to include the richest Chinese, the ones who had got richest at that time, as potential members of the Chinese Communist Party to be invited to go through the ideological education which everybody has to go through to become a member and become members, but that they could become members. Some of the older hands, well, he was pretty old too, but anyway, some of the more socialist of the in the party said, no, we can't possibly include capitalists, especially the big capitalists. So he didn't get it through the first year, and he got it through the next year. But there was opposition in the party, and there still is opposition in the party to this. But the party expanded in relation, it just expands in size, it becomes more inclusive. And that's one way in which the party itself has become a kind of political arena that people don't quite realize. That's what I was meaning earlier.
There's more variety of opinion.
It's more variety within the party. And the people who are most advancing Chinese culture or Chinese civilization are also to be welcomed into the party. The party considers itself to be at the peak of the growth of Chinese civilization. So one way or another, through what a lot of people think of as nationalism, but I'm just using the word pride in being Chinese, and some sense of what China has to do in a kind of project for itself, which is to become more modern, more civilized, more and together to have more modern civilization, as well as being more clean, more healthy, is part of the party's project. And that project comes up against the fact that there still are masses of very poor people in the cities, let alone outside the cities. And the present regime, Hu Jintao's regime, is very concerned about that. And so is trying, has tried quite successfully, to use the tax reforms that were introduced under Jiang Zemin and which replenished the central state funds so that it is actually able to have funds which it can redistribute from the richer provinces to the poorer, to establish a minimum health and schooling facility. So something, the beginnings of something like a welfare state, but it's a very small beginning so far, but at least not to have a minimum, to have some sense of a minimum income, that is the prevention of dire poverty, as well as something more than that, which is what the United Nations would think of as quality of life measures of for medical provision and school provision in the poorest areas. And that is something that might reduce the income gap.
We're going to talk about the ethnic composition of China and other topics when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Stefan Feuchtwang, who is from the London School of Economics and a China expert, and we're catching up on the phenomenon that is contemporary China. And we started from the get-go to say that it's a much more complicated place than the monolithic population and political beliefs that we have perhaps thought of in recent years. The population of China, when we say Chinese, what does that really mean?
Very good question. I keep challenging Chinese with different senses, with the fact that there are different senses of being Chinese. I would lecture about this part of China that a Chinese person listening to me would say, they're not proper Chinese. In other words, they're not like me. And be quite shocked when I said, but I've lived with these people. This is what they have said, and this is what they have done. So, in the first place, there are quite strong regional traditions in China. There are several Chinese spoken languages, one written language, but it's not phonetic, so it can be read by everybody and pronounced in the way that they learn to pronounce in school, which is a common spoken language. But as everybody knows, Cantonese is a completely different language, right? You go to Chinatown, it's the old Chinatowns where they spoke Cantonese. It's not the same language, spoken language, as is taught in schools in China and is spoken in most of northern China. But then there are several others. The province in which I'm most familiar is just north on the southeast coast of Guangdong, where they speak Cantonese. It's called Fujian. And there are several spoken languages, not just Fujianese. There's southern Fujianese, there's Fuzhouese, which is mutually unintelligible with it. In between, there's Putianese, which is not really terribly intelligible to the other two. And that's just in one province.
And I suppose in the same city. I mean, I knew a young woman who was from Shanghai and said she couldn't really communicate with her grandmother when her grandmother spoke Shanghaihua.
Absolutely. Yes. Shanghainese is a real difficulty for anybody who's, you know, not a Chinese. Well, actually, even for Chinese, I know that I go with my Chinese colleagues to do research in this or that part of China. And frequently they have to find somebody who speaks the local language to be able to talk basically to old people because they can't understand even how the old people pronounce the common Chinese language because it can be pronounced in very different ways. So that's one. The sense of local traditions is very strong in China in terms of cuisine or religious customs or language, or the prettiness of the women, or whatever it is that is always said about certain parts of China.
And what about race or ethnicity?
Right.
How do the Chinese conceive of that?
Well, since there was a national movement, a movement to turn China from an empire into a nation, the idea of being what they call Han, which is the majority Chinese.
It's about 90% or something?
Which is it's about 90%. It has been promoted, at first against the fact that the dynasty, the last Chinese dynasty, was Manchu, which is not at all unusual. I mean, there were half of the Chinese dynasties were not Han Chinese. So, but the nationalist movement turned it into part of its whole sense of being Chinese as being ethnically Chinese, and then created the Chinese flag, which has a number of small stars around a big star. And the big star is Han.
Oh, is that what that means?
And
oh.
The small stars are the major minority nationalities.
And so, what does it mean to be Han? How, if you're, when you meet someone who is Han, how do you know that? What goes with that?
It's both geographical and by some sort of sense of descent. The word for a nation is Minzu, which means a people line, like an ancestral line. So it's both. It's a sort of an expansion of the sense of being of one system of descent from a family to a much larger entity. So that people who think of themselves as being Han call themselves, for instance, the children of the Yellow Emperor, who is a mythical emperor, has temples in China, and sponsored by the state, or being in some way descended intellectually or spiritually from Confucius, or that they grew up in the, this is the regional part, in areas that geographers of China used to call China proper, that's certain provinces. But even within some provinces, you had minority nationalities. And in the West, of course, you have the West and the North, you have the big regions of people who have other literary traditions, in other words, other written languages, like the Manchurians, which is now northeastern China, or the Mongols. So there is an independent republic of Mongolia, but on the other side of its border is a so-called Inner Mongolia, which is Chinese Neimeng, which is a province, an autonomous province of China. So that's two of the big minorities. There, on the border with North Korea, there's a very big Chinese Korean community. So again, has another written and spoken language. And then, of course, there's the one that you're all expecting me to say, but I haven't yet got there, which is the Uyghurs in and others in the far west in Xinjiang, which goes stretch out into Central Asia, and the Tibetans, of course, who live not just in Tibet but in two other three other provinces of China, and each of those have not only their own spoken language but also their written languages, and then there are a number of much smaller ethnic minorities. The Chinese count 56 altogether, who have been written about in Chinese historical records, and therefore are included in China because they've been included to some more or less extent and at various different times as part of the Chinese Empire. Possibly as tributaries, rather than as they can be independent, independent princedoms or kingdoms, but they recognize the Chinese emperor as someone to whom they paid tribute.
Relationship between a communist government and religion in China?
Yes. Well, the most negative word used for popular religion in China by and that means the religions of the minority nationalities, as well as common people who are of the Han, is superstition, or even worse, feudal superstition. So backward and wrong, both. To be backward and wrong is to condemn it. But according to the doctrine of ideological persuasion and not against the use of force, the backward should be brought through education, through a knowledge of science or whatever it might be, away from their, quote, superstitions. And that was backed up by force at various times, especially during the Cultural Revolution, when there was quite a lot of destruction of the temples and monasteries and churches that had been built by Chinese, by ordinary Chinese people. But it was over a relatively short period, so that when the reforms occurred in 1978 to 1980, the opening out of China and the loosening of controls by the central government, they still had this category of superstition to suppress religion, but with the newfound wealth, people would spend it on what they wanted to spend it, which was to rebuild their ancestral halls, to rebuild their temples, and did so in to a greater and greater extent in all parts of China, not just those connected with overseas Chinese, who were the first main source of investment in China. So, of course, people think that the main Southeast coastal provinces, which had been the main sending areas for the overseas Chinese, would be the ones where the government would most, maybe reluctantly, but most tolerate the growth of the revival, the revitalization of religious institutions. It actually occurred inland, in the north, but in some areas it hasn't occurred, but in most areas it has, where people have just spent their newly earned money on their ancestors or on creating what they consider to be a public good, which is an annual festival for their local god, pride in their own local history through their local
well,
god.
So it's hard to separate, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you say ancestors, family history, let's say ethnic or regional history from superstition slash religion.
Absolutely impossible. And a number of other categories have now entered into the vocabulary of those who have to manage religious affairs, which is, I mean, always all the way through there has been a Bureau of Religious Affairs. But it's now not just that, but the Cultural Bureau, the Tourist Bureau, very importantly, at least those three have their own interests in the growth or growth under certain circumstances of religious institutions. They're a tourist attraction.
Sure. And do you have a sense of the religious, well, I guess, how many people in China are practicing Buddhists, are practicing, you know, Confucians, practicing something else? If you take the entire population of China, do you have any sense sort of roughly who's doing what?
I would say it's impossible to count. People do count. Christian organizations in particular try to count who are Christian, and they then compare that with who are Muslim or who are Buddhist, Taoist. But ordinary people mix religions, or the so-called religions, and they have their own sense of ritual. And into those rituals, some of the most important ones are death rituals, of course, you know, burial or cremation. In some areas, they'll be served by Buddhist monks. In other areas, the same ritual will be performed by Taoist priests. And so to say, you can count the number of graduates from Taoist seminaries and compare them with those who graduate from Buddhist and from Christian or from Muslim. I know Muslims don't really have seminaries, but you know what I mean. And there you would have to say that the Buddhists were the biggest, and then possibly Christians and then Muslims. But that's only those who are graduating from the seminaries and saying that they are followers of a religion. Ordinary people who are also followers of Buddhism and Taoism are far, far, far. Take me the rest of this program to say as many fars as I need to say, larger in number. And the idea that these are Buddhist or Taoist or just superstitious or customary is any one of those ideas is wrong. It's all of them.
We'll be looking further at China and particularly at the role of ethnicity and also those dissident writers when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Stefan Feuchtfang, and we are talking about contemporary China. The picture that I have of China is often sort of a duality where I can picture the really bustling, crowded cities, but also the rural China with the peasants who don't look that different than centuries ago. Mm. Can you say something about the split between the rural and the urban?
Yes, I can. There is a vocabulary that is used in schools and on slogans on the walls of cities or hanging from the lampposts of raising or being civilized, being or raising quality, raising the quality of your conduct. And Chinese peasants are thought of by urban dwellers in China, they're all lumped together as being backward. Chinese word is luohuo. And there's a lovely story of a Chinese, but from Taiwan, who came to the city of Dalian, which is in the northeast, a fairly large city in which he wanted to study the single-child families and the children who were at school there. And she hadn't ever been to Dalian, and she had made this contact, and she was walking along the street, looking everywhere up the high-rise buildings and around. And her companion, who was a citizen of Dalian, said, "Don't do that. That's very backward. You're just like a peasant to be gawping," right? So there is a kind of snobbery about the Chinese peasantry within China that can become and can be quite vicious. Since there are a lot of rural migrants in the cities, I mean hundreds, over 100 million. That's what I mean, people who are actually working in cities but who are registered and are in some ways obliged to go back home to their country place. The number of times that people who live in cities and who have their registration in that city can see these rural people, they're seeing them as poor, as fairly wretched, but with great ambitions, and who are in some ways undercutting in terms of their tolerance of menial work and of low wages, the urban poor, who are the local urban poor, who also need to find jobs and or peddle workers. And many of these are those who were formerly favoured as workers, proper industrial workers, in what you might call the Chinese Rust Belt. That is to say, manufacturing industries that have now gone, that have now been privatized or have just been closed. So you've got a lot of ex-urban workers who are competing with these new rural migrants and can't match it. They can't match their entrepreneurial spirit. They can't match their tolerance of low wages and resent it. And so when these male and female migrant workers use their wages to buy the latest fake Gucci handbag, say,
of which there are many,
of which
China.
There are a great many on sale here in the U.S. there is another story I heard of someone seeing a pair of young female workers, migrant workers, in Tiananmen Square, one photographing the other, standing with her newfound goods, proud of herself of having got this, just being barged into by somebody saying, "Oh, you dreadful migrants, what are you doing here? You've got no right to be here." It can be quite a cruel division. But the urban situation in China is the one for the future. There is, in terms of employment, more people are employed in non-agricultural work since 2003 or 4 than in agricultural work. That by agricultural, I'm including fishing, herding, as well as sowing. And the migration to cities is increasing, and everyone knows it, and the city governments themselves are trying to put in measures to assimilate the new migrants.
Is that rising standard of living in China sort of a two-edged sword, in that if that standard of living rises above a certain level, then China, from a manufacturing standpoint, from a labor standpoint, is not as competitive in the world market and risks losing business to Vietnam or to India?
I think it's partially true. But in general, no, China still has a pool of very cheap labor in the further west, you know, away from the richer parts of the economy. And that means that industries that would have been located in the Pearl River Delta, which is around Hong Kong, or Shanghai, or between Beijing and Tianjin, those are the big, big economic centers, are now moving inland to make...
To where
cheaper labor is, yes.
Could you say something about the role of men and women in contemporary China? I mean, there was such controversy a while back with the infanticide when there was the single child policy and no one wanted girls. There's this legacy of the bound feet and so on. And in terms of contemporary China and the role that women play, the relationship of girls and boys within a family, what's your assessment?
I think it's terribly interesting for people interested in gender relations to be studying this, and they do, of course. One is the fact that women have more opportunities, increasing opportunities to earn, to go out on their own and find waged work, and that I mean, there are no longer people with bound feet. Well, there still are some old enough with bound feet. I've seen them walking up pilgrimage temples, towards pilgrimage temples. But the bound foot tradition of male authority, which you're talking about, is still to some extent there, but very much now undermined by the fact that since collectivized work, which was in the late 50s, women have been brought into the labor market as individual earners. So there's a long history of, you know, this is the income I earned. You know, I want to have some say on how it's used within the household. But at the same time, quite interestingly, a lot of the studies of female migrant workers is what are they doing? They're earning in order to save up to get married. But through their own savings for their own dowry, right? It's not coming from their parents. It's coming from their own work. They want to go to Shenzhen, which is the big city just on the other side of the border with Hong Kong, for instance, to earn money, find a partner, if possible, then go back home to get married, but go back to his home to get married, but negotiate with his parents what they want and where they want to live, because it's going to be their own money that's being used. And the tendency is for women to be more and more independent, or the couple themselves, because they've chosen each other, to be more independent of either of their parents. So there's actually quite a lot of change in family composition. They still are responsible for the care of their elderly parents on both sides of the marriage, but also quite a lot of families who the Women's Federation of China was saying, you know, treasure girls, which is quite a lot of posters are up saying treasure girls. They're right to say treasure girls, because actually many parents actually then say, I want my daughter near me. I don't much care about if I have a son, because daughters look after us better than sons would. So there is a kind of change, I think, in the gender balance, still within something like a patriarchy, but it's not a terribly tough patriarchy any longer.
There's a wonderful book that came out in 1991 by a Chinese author who lives in Britain, Zhong Chang, Wild Swans, Three Women of China.
Mm.
Why was the Chinese government so against that book to ban it? We're talking about gender roles here, of course.
Yes, you are. I know her, and I met her mother, who is a wonderful woman, actually. I think the book is a very good read, especially when it talks about the two generations above her. And I think that part of the story would not have been objectionable.
Oh, really? It's the latter day.
It's her own life, and I find it slightly objectionable, not for the same reasons. Because she's basically saying her suffering during the Cultural Revolution was due to Mao, and she, quite unlike other memoirs which have been published in China, in which the person who's writing about themselves in the Cultural Revolution says, you know, we were enthusiastic about it. She denies that she was ever enthusiastic about being a Red Guard. So it's sort of totally anti instead of ambivalent about it, which I think is what she properly should have been, because, of course, she was part of that.
Do you have the same sense of the book that she co-authored with her husband about Chairman Mao?
I have even more of a sense
too
of that.
Anti.
It's not. I think it's just a rather uninteresting biography of Mao. Partly because it misses out the fact that he was a very complex man. He's a very, in their view, a very simple man, a megalomaniac from infancy onwards. But so, you know, he is a very complex man. Most people are complex. He's just
A large-scale complex.
We're almost out of time. Do you have a few kind of thoughts looking into China in the next year or two? What are you most interested to see in terms of trends and where we're going?
Well, I have a study project on urbanization, actually, on sustainable urbanization in China. What I'm really interested to see is how people who had a short while ago been living in villages that then got industrialized and now parts of cities are still living perhaps in some cases in the area that they've always lived in, that is to say their village, which is now part of a city, but in which they're having to deal with people who are now living right next to them and who didn't come from that village. And those tensions between migrants and locals, I think, are just one of the conditions of urbanization in China, which I'd be very interested to see. In general, I think the experimentation of the Chinese government is always interesting. It's hugely surprising always to me to see how much the Chinese government... There isn't a problem that anyone from the West can say exists in China that the Chinese own experts, especially those who advise on policy, don't already know. So the Chinese government either experiments or suppresses, right, as it is now, the dissident voices. But it's always experimenting with new ways of organizing cities. And it's always top-down. And I'm very interested in seeing how top-down urban planners, for instance, want to try to involve local people in ways that local people may not want to be involved. So how's that going to work out? And that's my project for the next few years.
We'll look forward to hearing more. Our guest has been Stefan Feuchtwang. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
He's a China expert with the London School of Economics, and we'll look forward to hearing more. I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me for the next hour with Emily Auerbach of University of the Air.